P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Betty Henderson, and we're going to be talking about a plague on America today. And that plague is largely mediated by a federal agency known as the Federal Drug Agency, the FDA. And of course, the FDA is in large part financed by the drug companies that is to regulate. Oh, of course, they say the reason that the drug companies give the FDA money is because, after all, they're evaluating whether the drugs that they are going to be putting on the market are safe. But the question is, don't you think that the fact that they... drug companies are putting up the money is going to influence the attitude of the people in the FDA, especially since many of them simply go to work for the FDA when they retire from the government and get fabulous salaries and golden parachutes and all sorts of rewards. Do you think that that might just influence one or two of those bureaucrats to put out information that is faulty and to allow drugs that are dangerous to be used on the American people? Well, we know the story of Vioxx. If you haven't read Dr. Graham's testimony, you need to go to my newsletters. And we just put forward the testimony that he gave before the Senate about what happened when he tried to stop Vioxx, because it was going to kill somewhere between 60 and 160,000 Americans, and they knew it. And they allowed it on the market, and they did everything they could to silence him. He actually had to go to Europe to get his article published. And, well, there's so many similar stories. But tonight we're going to be talking with Betty Henderson about another group of drugs that are multi-billion dollar drugs that are being inflicted on the American people. And if you look at the studies, you'll be amazed to find out just how effectively they really aren't. Betty Henderson, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and why you are so interested in this class of drugs they call selective serotonin absorption inhibitors.
Okay. I became interested in this when quite a few of my friends started falling apart after the Prozac first came out in 1988, and they started exhibiting bizarre behavior, and I was a little bit confused about this, and so I went to the physician's desk reference, and I looked up Prozac to see what was going on, and I was amazed to see what the side effects were, that they can cause mania and psychosis and abnormal thinking and personality disorders and emotional instability and alcohol abuse. And it says all this in the physician's desk reference.
Now they call
paranoid reactions. And so I got thinking about it, and I realized suddenly when it hit Newsweek magazine that the Prozac capsule was on the cover as a miracle pill, that millions of people were going to be going on this drug.
They call them selective serotonin reabsorption inhibitors, SSRI. That's what it is. And it prevents the serotonin inhibitors from being reabsorbed, so you get a very high level of serotonin. And of course, that's supposedly going to help you if you're depressed or have some other affliction. But what about the side effects of it? And, well, we're going to be talking to Betty Henderson, because this is truly one of the most amazing stories. Well, it's almost as incredible as the story of of statin drugs, which we're told decrease your heart attack and stroke by 30%. The difference between 3% and 2% is 30%, isn't it?
Hello?
Well, Betty, you go right ahead and pick up the story.
Oh, okay. So anyway, I decided to see if I could find as many stories as I could in the newspapers. Of course, this was a little bit before. This was before the computers, like 1993 and 4. And I found quite a few cases, and I wrote to people called the Prozac Survivor Support Group, and they sent me literature on a lot of murder cases that had been happening of people on Prozac, a lot of lawsuits that were going on, like the Westbecker case up in Kentucky, where in his printing plant he murdered 8 people and killed himself. There's a lot of murder-suicides involved in this. And so, although I do want to say, first of all, if anybody is taking any of these drugs, not ever to go off them abruptly. That's the most dangerous thing you can do. And in the very cover page of my website, SSRIstories.com, it says, warning, withdrawal can often be more dangerous than continuing on the medication. It is important to withdraw extremely slowly from these drugs, usually over a period of a year or more under the supervision of a qualified specialist. And then, of course, there are some people that think they're doing okay on the SSRI, like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa, Lexapro, you know, whatever, Cymbalta. And so they should always talk to their doctor if they have any concerns about it. I'm not a doctor, and I'm not trying to tell anybody to go off of it. I'm just trying to warn people that these drugs can cause you to become a maniac and to kill other people. And I think that this is the most horrible side effect a drug has ever had, is to kill other people.
And actually, the increase of homicidal and paranoid and suicidal activity in some of the people is dramatically increased, isn't it?
Oh, yes, and there's a total change in personality in people, you know. And it's just the school shootings, for instance, between 1891 and 1976, which is almost 100 years, there were 4 school shootings. One, the Charles Whitman down in Texas, had a brain tumor and so forth. Now, since Prozac came out and all the other copycat drugs like Zoloft and Paxil and stuff, we've had, probably 60 or 70 school shootings. I have 48 up on my website where they were taking these drugs. I mean, of course, Columbine is the most famous, but there was Red Lake, Minnesota, and Northern Illinois University, and so on.
Well, now, do you include in that some of the children who are on Ritalin as well?
No, I have not included.
All right.
I have not.
All right, that's fine. I just want to know, these are just the ones on the Prozac.
This is strictly selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors,
okay.
SSRIs. And the reason I didn't include Ritalin is not because I think that Ritalin is a great drug or anything, so I certainly don't.
Hold on, though. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, Betty, this is Dr. Stan. Betty Henderson is talking about her website where she lists a large number of school shootings. She said, over 100 years, I think 4 school shootings, since we've had the children on these drugs that promote homicidal and suicidal tendencies, why the number of school shootings has gone up dramatically. And we're told, it's the guns that do it. But nobody questions the fact that most of these young people are on these psychotropic types of drugs. How many instances do you actually have on your website?
Of school shootings or incidences, there's 48 cases. And these are just that I was able to find either through books or through going on Google News and getting them, or coming from journal articles. See, these are not personal stories. These are stories that have appeared in the newspapers or media or journal articles or on some media news group. And so this is a reporter actually reporting the news, saying like Eric Harris was taking Luvox, which is an SSRI like Prozac, at the time of Columbine shootings. And things like this.
How about Klebold there? Was he on the...
His records were sealed.
I see. They
so
don't want them.
Nobody has ever known if he was on anything, although both he and Eric Harris were in an anger management class where they did give these type of drugs.
I see. Well, why would they seal that? I mean, what are they trying to conceal from the American people? Why would you seal the records of a multi-killer?
That's a very good question, Dr. Stan. I hope somebody can answer that, why so much of this is secret, why people don't know this. I don't understand why people don't know this. I know probably a lot of the general public has realize that there's been a tremendous increase in the number of murder-suicides going on. Are you aware of that yourself?
Oh, well, I'm not aware of it, but I'm trying to do is get our listeners aware of this as well. But let's look at it from the other side, Betty. I mean, some people say that this really has helped them. These people have been depressed, and elevating their serotonin levels in their brain has made them feel ever so much better. What do the studies show about the effectiveness of SSRI drugs on helping people, say, with depression?
Well, during the clinical trials, 60% felt better on the drugs and 40% felt better on a placebo. So that's only 20% that actually did better on the drugs, which is one out of five people. But then when they further analyzed it over in England, they realized that the people who were having the side effects of nausea and stuff from the drugs were kind of aware that they were on the drug, and so this took away another 10%. So actually only about 10% of all people are feeling better from depression and those sort of things on these drugs. And then, of course, they hid some of the studies like Duke University and Southwestern Medical Center, where they showed that exercise 3 to 4 times a week for 35 minutes was as effective as the drugs, as Zoloft. They use Zoloft, which is an SSRI like Prozac is. And so there's a lot of also cognitive behavioral therapy where you can talk out your troubles and try to, adjust your thinking. That's it. That is as effective as these drugs. And other things like taking omega-3 capsule oils, that kind of improves your mood. Sunlight, get out in the sunlight. But see, people don't hear this. They just go to the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, well, take this Cymbalta, this SSRI, And so we have to find another way because, there was an 82-year-old man here in Texas who took Cymbalta, and he killed his wife. And then when he saw what he did, he called the police and said, I can't believe I killed her, and he tried to kill himself. And he was found not guilty?
Well, I think that's amazing.
We have 17 cases up there of people who were found not guilty because the drug was...
But of course, this information is totally suppressed from the American people.
Yes,
the last thing they want is for the American people to realize that the FDA has knowingly released these drugs, which they know to be harmful. In fact, they even, of course, allowing this to be used in children, it has never been proven safe for children, has it?
Well, no, of course, they put a black box warning on suicidality in children in 2004. The FDA did, But what happened was, in their first meeting, on February 2nd, 2004, when the pharmacological committee met for the FDA, it turned out that they had asked an FDA member to go over the clinical trials that were done on the children with these SSRIs. And his name was Dr. Andrew Mosholder. And he said that he came up with the conclusion that children were 2 to 3 times more likely to have suicidal behavior when they were on these drugs in the clinical trials than when they were on the sugar pill, the placebo. And they suppressed that. The FDA suppressed that. And so this started to come out just as people were at the meeting, to discuss the antidepressants and suicidality in children. And so many parents got up there and complained that the FDA said, well, of course, they still didn't make a decision in February. This was February 2nd, 2004. They said, we'll have Columbia University do a study. And because her hand was kind of forced. Otherwise, they would have had egg in their face, that all the TV crew was there and everything to see this. So they did the Columbia study, and Columbia said, yes, children under the age of 18 were 2 to 3 times more likely to have suicidal behavior on this drug than on placebo when we looked at the clinical trials. So they put a black box warning on it for the children. But see, the FDA fought it all the way. And then it got so bad that they were having so many reports of, like, bizarre behavior and things like that, that in March 22nd, 2004, they did put out, the FDA put out a warning. But nobody knows about it. It's up on my website, and it's on the cover page. It's called the FDA Public Health Advisory. And let me tell you a little bit about what it says. It says that these drugs can cause anxiety, agitation, panic attacks, insomnia, irritability, hostility. That's their polite word for homicide. Impulsivity, severe restlessness, hypomania, and mania in adult and pediatric patients being treated with these antidepressants for major depressive disorder as well as for other indications. Now listen to this, both psychiatric and non-psychiatric. They were having people who were taking it for like a back pain. You know, sometimes they would give these drugs for back pain, or even we had one case of a poor girl, 15 years old, who was giving this drug, Zoloft, for warts, and she killed herself. So, I mean, these are happening just in people who aren't even depressed or have any kind of psychiatric disability.
What would be the rationale of giving it to somebody with warts? Why would you want to give somebody with warts a psychiatric drug?
Well, I think sometimes doctors think that teenagers are depressed. You know, she might have said something like, he probably said, how you doing? You got warts. And she said, yeah, it's really, you know, really depressing. And he thought, well, I'll perk her up. I'll give her, you know, Zoloft for warts. I mean, I don't know what physicians are thinking. I don't really understand why physicians haven't noticed this and why there's not a big outcry over it.
Because they are constantly besieged by detail men and very attractive detail women. I know I was practiced medicine for many years, and they would come around at the end of the day to see the doctor and make an appointment, and they would tell you how wonderful these drugs were and not to worry about any of these reports about all these terrible complications. It just wasn't true, and the company was there. They would never put anything out that wasn't good, and it was even better. And let me give you a few little gifts here, you know.
Right.
Basically, the detail people are employed to lie to the doctors. Now, maybe the detail people really don't know it. I don't think they do. They just are doing what they've been told to do and what they're paid to do, and they're very convincing, and not only that, but if you don't hear about this at the meetings you go to, it isn't discussed, you know, in the journals that you read.
No, the journals won't discuss it. That's why I don't understand, like, the American Medical Association journals, why they don't discuss these side effects.
Well, because, of course, they carry advertisements on the pages of their journal for these products, and you don't bite the hand that feeds you. And basically, these are beautiful journals. They're very expensive to print. They're glossy paper. But those beautiful ads, and, of course, those would stop immediately if they were to dare to criticize the drugs. In fact, many times the drug companies will threaten to sue people who bring out the truth.
That's true. There's a journal called the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons.
Yes, I subscribe to that and have for many years.
Oh, okay. In this spring, in 2009, a doctor, Joel Kaufman, he's a professor of chemistry emeritus at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. He wrote an article entitled Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitors, that is SSRI drugs, are there more risks than benefits? And here's what he said about SSRIstories.com, my website. He made the following statement. Since no clinical trial involving multiple homicides is ever likely to be run, no firmer evidence is likely to be found. Dr. David Healy, he's a noted professor, noted that much of the evidence for suicides and murders came from the efforts of journalists and lawyers. So you see that the scientists and the doctors aren't really involved in this.
Well, no, when was that article written by Dr. Kaufman, do you recall?
Yes, it was volume 14, number 1, spring 2009.
Okay, fine. Well, that's earlier this year. Fine, I will have that, and I'm sure I take it. I usually have so many things to read, I don't read everything I should. Is that the one that just came out? No, this would be the one before that, I'm
Let's
sure.
Let's see, this is spring 2009. I don't know if the summer edition has come out yet.
All right, well then, I may very well have it. I just saw it the other day, and I started to read it. I noticed the article, at least this one or the one before that, but I'll have to admit I didn't read it. But our guest is Betty Henderson. And, of course, we're talking about SSRI, Selective Serotonin Reabsorption Inhibitors. Go right ahead, Betty.
Oh, okay. So, anyway, I do want to reiterate again for anybody who's listening and is taking these drugs, not to let this frighten them in the sense that I don't ever go off these.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Is very effectively being suppressed. Now our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you'd like to give us a call. Why, we'd love to hear from you. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course we're discussing of the SSRI drugs, these selective serotonin reabsorption inhibitors. You know, that is really quite a tongue twister. I'm sure it really is almost designed to confuse people. What these drugs do is that they actually prevent the reabsorption of serotonin, which is one of the mediators of the brain. And so you get high levels of serotonin in the brain, and supposedly that's going to make you happy and cheerful. And, you know, I've talked to some people who said they felt better on this. But you have to understand that a significant part of the people on a placebo think that they feel better on that as well. Isn't that true, Betty?
Yes, that is true. In the clinical trials, it was 60% felt better in the drug and 40% on the placebo. So, I mean, you know, it's just strange. When people are depressed and they go in and the doctor says they're going to give them a drug that makes them feel better, that's a very strong, even if it's a sugar pill, they feel better, you know. They think they're going to feel better, and so they do, and they feel like people are helping them and that they're getting social support. Social support is very important, too, for people's mental health, you know, to have somebody to talk to and to say, you know, you're going to feel better now and that sort of thing.
Well, I think it's one of the big things, of course, is diet, and we are what we eat. We have an excellent DVD by our good friend, Dr. Russell Blaylock, called Nutrition and Behavior. And it actually points out there are studies that show that even in people with frank schizophrenia and delusional states, if you can correct their diet, many of these people, almost universally, they would get better, put them back on the regular American diet, and they got worse again. And they know this to be the true. And yet, of course, this is almost never brought out, and most doctors have never heard about the relationship, a very real relationship between nutrition and behavior. So if you're out there in the listening audience and you have family members who do have these problems, why, we do carry this DVD. We think it's one of the most important ones. I wish we'd produced it ourselves, but it's produced by Russell's son. On the other hand, we think it's a great message which we need to get out. Well, Betty, certainly as you talk about this, and I know you've done a lot of work with this, are there other people out there on the front lines? We've interviewed Dr. Frank Bowman, who talks about that. Are there any other people out there trying to awaken the American people?
Oh, yes. There's quite a few. Well, of the doctors, the MDs. Out in Boston, there's Dr. Joseph Glenn Mullen. He's written a number of books about one is the antidepressant solution. And he also testifies in court trials. And overseas, we have Dr. David Healy. He's written hundreds of articles and probably 20 books on antidepressants. He's considered the antidepressant historian. And he firmly believes that these drugs can cause suicide and homicide. I will say that. And he's a very intelligent man. And so we have a lot of people, Dr. Fred Bauman, like you said, yes, and there's Dr. Weeks and other doctors that, you know, say this, but, I mean, that's just a few doctors, you know, a handful compared to how many doctors there are in the United States or the world.
I remember there was that tragic case of the woman with postpartum depression. She had a postpartum depression after her fourth pregnancy, and then she was pregnant again. And after her fifth pregnancy and five children, she had this terrible depression, and so they put her on these drugs, and she ended up killing all five of her children, and then calling the police and said, "I just drowned my children." And you said why she was declared not guilty for reason of insanity, but nobody brought out the fact that similar things have happened, unexplainable things have happened so many times when people have actually been on these psychotropic medications. But that their tendency to create homicidal reactions wasn't even brought up.
No, it wasn't, and that was really sad. And I know that that was Andrea Yates's case.
Right.
And her husband, Rusty Yates, firmly believes that the drugs are what did it. What happened was after the birth of her fourth baby, she had postpartum depression. And she was given an antipsychotic and recovered after a couple months, and so she went off the antipsychotic. And she wanted another baby because she wanted a girl, I guess. But anyway, she had four boys, and she did have a girl.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Betty Henderson. And, of course, we're talking about the SSRI drugs, which have created so many problems. And one of the big problems is the doctors really don't know. And the problem is, of course, there's an organized effort to suppress information on the very real dangers of these drugs. They're there, but you're never going to hear about them. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess Betty Henderson, and Betty, I want you to get your web page out and any other contact information you'd like to get out. If you have a book or anything you've written, why just go ahead and mention that right now.
Oh, okay. My website is www.ssristories.com. So, and that's that. Then when you go into the cover page there, there's a whole explanation all about what the FDA said, what the physician's desk reference says. It names which drugs are SSRIs and SNRIs and so on. And then you can click and go into 3,165 media articles where there was a criminal act, and where in this media article, which drug the person was taking is mentioned, which SSRI or SNRI. Like Andrea Yates was taking two antidepressants. She was taking both Effexor and Remeron. And she became psychotic on it because psychosis is listed as a side effect, and not a rare one, Dr. Stan. It's only listed as infrequent. Agitation is listed as frequent in the physician's desk reference for these drugs. So is confusion and amnesia and sleep disorders. These are all listed as frequent. And so it's very, very sad. Anyway, so these articles are in the index, and then you can, they're lined up in columns of five. And on the left-hand side is, it says what, and then date and where, like, you know, Texas or Alabama or so on. And then a little bit of which drug, you know, like was it Zoloft or Prozac or Paxil or Cymbalta or Lexapro or whatever. And then it says what. And in the left-hand column says what. It's in blue, and you can click on that, and that pulls up the media article. And there's right in the media article up at the top, there's a little bit of blurb that just tells what drug the person was on and how long they were taking it or whatever. And then you can read the whole media article.
Well, now, if you're out in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, for the physician, usually an obstetrician, who's going to have a patient with a postpartum depression, and she's obviously depressed, he puts her on the drug, and she begins to get psychotic, what's the response? Well, I'm going to give another drug, you know. She's getting worse, so we're going to have to give her more of the drugs without
the realizing. The other drug they gave her was an antidepressant.
I know.
Yes, that's what was so sad. I mean, they should have taken her off the antidepressants very slowly, hospitalized her, and got her stabilized, and the whole thing is, of course, then, the thing that's happening, Dr. Stan, is, like, there was a case in Louisiana of this Paula Pinkard. She killed her 11-year-old daughter, and she was given probation because they said that the Prozac that she was taking caused her to kill her daughter. But here's the catch. They said the reason it caused her to kill her daughter was that she was actually bipolar. She was actually mentally ill, and nobody knew it, see. So they gave her the wrong drug or something. They gave her an antidepressant that made her manic and so on. But this is not good, because what it's saying is that there could be thousands of millions of people. They're just saying that all these people are running around with mental illnesses, and you give them the drug, and that's just bringing it out. They said she had a latent mental illness, and nobody knew it. So you give them an antidepressant, and then you find out they're mentally ill, and you only find out after they kill somebody. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense.
Well, Betty, we live in a world gone mad. There are only a few of us that are sane, and most people think we're crazy because we're talking about these things, and people are saying if it were true, I would be reading about this in the newspaper. If it were true, why 60 Minutes would be exposing this sort of thing, without realizing, of course, that the media and whether television or most radio or most magazines or most newspapers are already, carry drug ads or ads from other corporations owned by the same people. There are big bucks behind these. I mean, these are multi-billion dollars.
Yeah, what? Right, Dr. Stan. If that had been LSD that she was taking, you know, Paula Pinkard or even Andrea Yates, they would have said, oh, that's what caused it, you know, the LSD. You see what I'm saying? That was an illegal drug, or if she was taking cocaine or heroin or meth or something. But the legal drugs, they can't say that because they're advertised. The media depends on the legal drugs for their advertisements.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Daniel calling from Santa Cruz. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Hi, Daniel. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing okay, Doc.
Do you have a question or comment?
Well, as far as all these fancy drugs they have out now these days, I tell you, my own personal experience as a long-term mental patient, I started out with mania, about a severe psychotic bout with mania when I was 19, and they called it an acute schizophrenic break and gave me a leave of absence, which has been extended. Now I'm 59, and to the best of my knowledge, I'm still on a medical leave of absence from UCSC.
Well, Daniel, has anybody ever, have you been on a lot of these psychotropic medications through the years?
Yeah, I mean, I was on lithium carbonate for maybe 30 years, and mm-hmm. it just about did in my kidneys.
All right. Have anybody ever suggested altering your diet and trying to get you onto a vegan type of diet?
Well, I tell you, I was headed that way when I was in my 20s. I gave up killed meat and all that, and then on my 26th birthday, my grandmother got me over to her place and all my cousins there, and she spent $80 on a leg of lamb, and would have shamed me if I'd.
Well, Daniel, you're 50. You're 59. You got to start taking control of your life. Sydney Betty, what would you say to Daniel?
Well, I would tell Daniel that I think that he should look into all kinds of ways that he could help himself in the sense of not just diet, but diet is, of course, very, very important. But does he exercise? Do you exercise, Daniel?
Not enough. I try to take walks and stuff, but I'm in really poor health.
Okay,
I nearly died.
Are you in poor health from the lithium hurting your kidneys?
Yeah, I nearly died of a lithium toxicity that developed when my doctor changed.
Well, Daniel,
one of my meds.
After 40 years, all I can say is you need to start taking care of your health, and you need to start getting into this whole thing on nutrition and exercise. Our good friend Dr. Day has written extensively on that. You can go to her website, drday.com, fascinating material, and certainly it complements the information put out by our good friend Dr. Blaylock. If you ever want to talk to me off the air, you're certainly welcome to call. God bless you. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And the trouble is that there's so many people out there that I really dare hear you talking about, a 19-year-old student goes into a depression, and 40 years later, now he's 59 years of age, and his life is wasted and gone, and what a tragedy.
Well, yes, it really is, and there's a journal article up there on SSRI Stories Index, when you go into the index, and it says that 60% of the people who took an antidepressant were later diagnosed as bipolar. I mean, you have to read that, Of course, I don't know if that young man, I don't think he took an antidepressant. He might have been, drinking too many Cokes or something, too much caffeine. You just never know, what is going on in people's lives.
With the aspartame.
Might have been under a lot of stress,
But certainly, so many of the things, MSG, aspartame, these excitotoxins that are in so many of our foods, and nobody
ever
kills
them. Yes, they are. They're in aspartame in every place. I mean, it's just kind of unbelievable, the excitotoxins that are in our food, all the additives.
And of course, the heavy metals we get with our vaccinations, the mercury, the aluminum, and there's so many things that in our environment that attack our brains. And certainly, you do not see this sort of thing in other societies as you see it here. Well, go right ahead, Betty.
Well, what I wanted to say, there's also another journal article in the index that says between 1995 and 2004, there were an additional 4.8 million people who were diagnosed as bipolar, and the majority of those were because they took an antidepressant, and that set off a bipolar reaction. See, in other words, what they're saying is that, in my opinion, what they're saying is that these antidepressants are what's causing everybody to become bipolar. It used to be that bipolar was considered a rare disease affecting less than 1% of the population. And now they're saying it's affecting 5-6% of the population. Have you noticed, you'll read a news article, they'll say so-and-so is bipolar, It's kind of a new term. They used to call it manic depression. Now it's called bipolar. And even the novels I read, the characters have bipolar disorder. It's just, and I think that the antidepressants have set this off. What you don't realize is how many people are taking these antidepressants. They say that one out of six people in the United States at one time or another has attempted to take these antidepressants. And so that's like 50 million people. And currently, one out of 10 people is taking an antidepressant.
But of course, the problem
so that's
is 30 that it's
million. There's 300 million people in the United States, so 30 million people are on antidepressants.
Well, that must be very, very profitable for the drug companies.
Oh, yeah, they make billions.
Well, we're talking about billions of dollars
a
year.
It's not millions, it's billions.
Billions of dollars a year for the drug companies that are actively doing everything they can to suppress this information, to convince doctors everybody ought to be on this if they got an emotional problem. What about the effect of the lithium? I know that's not your specialty, but
well,
does this create lots of problems?
Lithium is not an SSRI. It's a mood stabilizer. And it can be very hard in the kidneys. I should think that, I wonder if he was monitored closely, because he said he had lithium toxicity. When you take lithium, I believe you're supposed to go in for blood tests ever so often to make sure that the level is, you know, correct in your body. And the problem is the level that's supposed to be helping you is very close to the level of toxicity, so it's a real tricky drug, you know. But the sad thing is some people could go their whole life and never become manic until they take an antidepressant. And so then once they take the antidepressant, then they have to take a mood stabilizer and an antipsychotic and a benzodiazepine, and then they get depressed, so then they go back on an antidepressant, so they're on four or five drugs, and pretty soon they're on two mood stabilizers. The next thing you know, they're on six or seven drugs, and that gets kind of scary, because once you're medicated to the hilt, your life expectancy goes way down. You know, people who are medicated to the hilt with these psychotropic drugs live 15 to 25 years less than the average person.
Are there actually studies that show that it shortens the lifespan of the individual who takes multiple psychotropic drugs?
Yes, there are. There are studies that show this. It used to be that before they got the really toxic drugs, these new mood stabilizers are extremely toxic, and so are the new atypical antipsychotics. They used to say that it shortened your life by 15 years. Now they're saying 25. You can find these studies. I mean, they're all over the Internet.
Well, do you have them posted on your website as well?
Yes, we have some of them on our journal articles on the website. You just have to go through and pick them out, you know. It's just kind of a national tragedy, really, when you combine it with the fact that so many people are committing murders and suicides on these antidepressants alone. So if you take an antidepressant, you start acting bizarrely, and somebody calls the doctor and said, my wife just started taking Prozac or Zoloft or something, and she's acting weird. Instead of taking them off so many times, the doctors will say, oh, that's a sign that she's like bipolar or something. So let's add a mood stabilizer to that, or let's add an antipsychotic along with it, you know? That's how they start getting on all these drugs. Instead of saying, let's very, very, very slowly take her off this antidepressant, give her a lot of rest, make sure then that she has social support and gets the proper nutrition and exercise and see if she can go back to normal again, you know. They don't do that. Instead, they just add these drugs, you know. Well, so she became nutty on the antidepressant, so we'll just add a mood stabilizer and an antipsychotic, and to help her sleep, we'll give her a sedative like a benzodiazepine. And I mean, you saw with Michael Jackson, I mean, how many drugs he was on, you know?
Right.
And this is just an example that, I don't know, I just really believe the American people are just so over-medicated. Do you feel that way, Dr.
Well, of course I do. And the thing is that you're far better off if you can just stay away from all medicines. There are a few medicines that obviously are very, very beneficial. I take Digitalis for congestive heart failure and a diuretic. These are standard medications that are around for a long time, and they work. But it's these psychotropic drugs that affect your mind that are really frightening. And then how long does it really take you to get off of these once they've been started?
That's another problem, see, that everybody's warning about the withdrawal. There's all kinds of websites now about how to get off of the SSRIs, because that's a tricky thing in itself. We had a shooting at Northern Illinois University last year where the fellow had abruptly quit Prozac, and then he got up in a stage and shot six kids and shot himself. And it was a withdrawal. It can cause this called withdrawal mania.
Well, because we saw this a young man at Virginia Tech. I think he killed some, 20 people, something like that. And of course, he was on these medications.
Yes, they haven't come out, and actually they won't release the autopsy, so we don't know, except the New York Times did report that his roommate saw him taking a medication, a prescription medication, that morning.
Course, why won't they release his autopsy?
Because there's so many billions of dollars involved in it, Dr. Stan.
Well, I know, but why don't we talk about the effect of the psychotropic drugs that create these homicidal tendencies? I mean, I would think that the people would be entitled to know that. Instead of attacking the fact that he had a gun or a couple of guns, we'd be, you know, it wasn't the guns that killed the people. It was the guy who pulled the triggers on the guns and loaded the guns. And, of course, what had these drugs done to his mind?
Well, that's true. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we can have guns and Prozac at the same time. You know, it's just gotten to be really awful. At the Virginia Tech, he killed 33 people. And so what can you say about something like that except that these drugs are just so dangerous?
Well, I think that one thing you ought to say is we ought to get the autopsy results and find out what they show. Obviously, somebody, there's a cover-up. There's a very conscious cover-up. Why would Klebold's medical records be kept sealed? I mean, the Columbine was almost 10 years ago.
So, I know.
And so, obviously, ladies and gentlemen, there is a cover-up. There are billions of dollars at stake, and it's about time the American people begin to do the research their own. So if they go to Betty's website, www.ssristories. And, of course, you need to get the material we have. We have interviews with Dr. Fred Bowman as well, and we really need a four-seat stat on this subject. Well, let's see. I think we have Marilyn or Mazarin. Let's see who's calling in. Hi, who's calling in?
This is Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn. Okay. Thank you so much. There's no
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Cancer treatment, and we can thank the FDA for suppressing this. We have a four-tape set on statin drugs. You need to know how dangerous the statin drugs are, and of course they've been effectively suppressed by me. They've been encouraged when these drugs should never have been put on the market because of the complications and the fact that they are not effective. And if you look at the information on Lipitor, and they will tell you that there's a 30% reduction in heart attack and stroke. But if you read the fine print, you find out that means if you take 100 people and you give all of them placebos, three of them will die. If you take another 100 people and you give them the statin drugs, only two of them will die. And the difference between three and two is 30%, isn't it? Ladies and gentlemen, figures don't lie, liars figure. And based upon a 1% difference in morbidity rate or mortality rate, why a multi-billion-dollar industry has been founded. The greatest scam of all time, and of course many people have died and developed cancer, all sorts of complications, rhabdomyolysis, from these drugs. And, of course, the small benefit that we see is probably related to their anti-inflammatory effect. You'd get exactly the same thing if you were taking aspirin. So, basically, our four-tape set on statin drugs, our four-tape set on Dr. Brzezinski, his treatment for cancer, Dr. Blaylock's DVD, it's entitled Nutrition and Behavior, and, of course, we have a four-tape set on Ritalin. You need to know what they're doing, and they know what they're doing. And you want to know about the Federal Drug Administration, we carry a book written by the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, the single most prestigious medical journal in the United States. Dr. Marcia Angel wrote a book entitled What You Should Know About the Drug Company. She was on the staff at Harvard. She won't even answer her emails, or wouldn't some years ago, because of the tremendous pressure she was put on. They were tracking her every move, and I know that because I debated somebody from the pharmaceutical industry one time and mentioned her, and they knew they were watching everything she did. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the world we live in, and you're going to have to start looking after your health. You need to get a wonderful book we carry, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life by Dr. Blaylock. We have a four-tape set by Dr. Blaylock on life-saving secrets, and we have so much other material on health and health issues. And certainly you need to start getting information on what you should take. We have another book by Dr. Blaylock, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients. And if you didn't hear that wonderful interview we did with Dr. Blaylock on cancer and what should be done for cancer, we have that. We interviewed him, I think, just Tuesday of this week. So, again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you want to know why we have cancer, you should hear the talk. Basically, it was actually interviews with Dr. Dunnigan. It's called The New Order of the Barbarians, going into the plan to suppress cancer treatments. And then, of course, you need to get our four-tape set on Why Do We Still Have Cancer? Our four-tape set on Laetrile, and we have so much other information. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Start taking charge of your health. And if you don't, why, of course, you'll have nobody to blame at all but yourself. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. Why would people suppress information? Well, some of it's for money. But there really are evil people out there who hate humanity. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and then please pray for Radio Liberty. Have a wonderful Fourth. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, hopefully, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who was formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine. And Sidney is a prolific writer. He's written a number of books. We carry his book, Liberty and Eclipse. That's Liberty and Eclipse. It's available from Radio Liberty. And William now has his own talk show. It's actually on opposite mine from 4 to 5 in the evening, Pacific time. And, of course, that would be a 7 to 8 Eastern time. But William does a wonderful job. Certainly is one of our favorite guests here at Radio Liberty as far as going on what covering the issues of the day. But right now, of course, tomorrow is going to be Independence Day, and what we need to do is understand really the significance of what happened that day. As 56 men gathered together in Philadelphia and signed their names to the Declaration of Independence, which declared that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their the just power from the consent of the governed. What rights were they going, of course, to preserve? They were going to preserve our God-given rights. Now, in many textbooks today, they will take that quotation, only they'll put four little dots where it says, and endowed by their Creator, because, of course, there is a conspiracy against God. You could not have liberty if you do not have a moral people. In fact, it was John Adams who said our form of government was made for a moral and religious people who would not work for any other. And because our seminaries, our Christian and Catholic seminaries, have been infiltrated, there's some Catholic seminaries you can't get into if you're not a homosexual. And certainly we have very real problems in the Protestant seminaries, and they've changed the music of our churches. Have you noticed how the music has changed? They've changed the message of our churches, and of course they've eroded the Christian foundation that once made America the envy of the world. Well, I want you to think about that tomorrow. I want you to understand that our freedom comes from God, not from government. Government does not give us any rights at all. God gives us those rights, and the governments are instituted to preserve those rights, both at the national and certainly at the state and local level. Every one of our individual states is a republic. Not one of them is a democracy. And it doesn't matter what the media tells you. It doesn't matter what our politicians tell you. It doesn't matter what you learned in school. You've been lied to. America's a republic. And that reason we're losing our freedom is because we are acting as if we're a democracy, and democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and are certainly incompatible with individual liberty, and is usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. Go ahead. We have William Grigg with us. Go right ahead, William.
Well, good evening, Dr. Stan. It's a blessing to be with you. I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity to speak with you and your audience this evening on the eve of Independence Day. And it's always a time for reflection, and often a very sober and chastening time when you think about the wonderful patrimony we were given by incredibly brave and principled men and incredibly brave and principled women. And then you compare the situation that confronted the colonists in 1774, 1775 with our present circumstances.
Hold that thought, William. We'll be right back. Go right ahead, William.
I really appreciate the fact that you were talking about the indispensable foundational understanding that our rights as individuals come from God, and that they are rights that individuals were given, that you don't have a situation in which we have contingent and revocable privileges given to us by other men, other creative beings, but rather each of us as a unique creation who bears the impress of our Creator in our countenances was given these rights. I don't know if you're familiar with David Ramsey, not the contemporary David Ramsey who's the financial advisor, but the 18th century American jurist of the same name, who spelled his name R-A-M-S-A-Y rather than S-E-Y, who wrote a two-volume history of the American Revolution right after the Revolution was finished. It's probably, in my opinion, and granted, my knowledge of the subject is not comprehensive, but I think it is the best contemporaneous source on the actual events of the Revolution and the philosophy that propelled the colonial patriots to secede from the British Empire and to assert their station as free and independent states. What he talks about here very early in his history is that the state of society and the colonies favored a spirit of liberty and independence. Their inhabitants, meaning the inhabitants of the English colonies, were all of one rank. Kings, nobles, and bishops were unknown among them. From their first settlement, the English provinces received impressions favorable. Forgive me. From their first settlement, the English provinces received impressions favorable to free forms of government. Many of them, that is, many of the colonists, had never heard of Magna Carta, and those who knew the circumstances of the remarkable period of English history when that was obtained did not rest their claims to liberty and property on the transactions of that important day. They looked up to heaven as the source of their rights, and claimed not from the promises of kings, but from the parent of the universe. The political creed of an American colonist was short but substantial. He believed that God made all mankind originally equal, that he endowed them with the rights of life, property, and as much liberty as was consistent with the rights of others, that he had bestowed on his vast family of the human race the earth for their support, and that all government was a political institution between men naturally equal, not for the aggrandizement of one or a few, but for the general happiness of the whole community. Impressed with sentiments of this kind, they grew up from their earliest infancy with that confidence which is well calculated to inspire a love of liberty and a prepossession in favor of independence. Colonists growing up in the enjoyment of such rights felt the restraint of law more feebly than they who are educated in countries...
Hold that thought. Right. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and then certainly William is simply reading to us from a book that was written immediately after the Revolutionary War, which was fought from 1775 until about 1780. And it was written by Mr. David Ramsey, just talking about where these ideas of freedom came from. Unique in all nations, because it was the belief of the colonists that freedom came from God. Go right ahead, Dave.
Yeah, uniquely, that was the distinguishing trait of the American concept of government, was that government was intended to preserve the rights that were the result of a direct transaction between the individual and his maker, that those rights were not filtered through a human intermediary, and they were not contingent upon the permission of a king or a noble or a feudal lord, but rather, by virtue of being created in the image of God, an individual had those rights, and that government could serve no useful function apart from protecting those rights. And David Ramsey continues here by saying that colonists, growing up in the enjoyment of such rights, felt the restraint of law more feebly than they who are educated in countries where long habits have made submission familiar. The mind of man naturally relishes liberty, where from the extent of a new and unsettled country, some abridgments thereof are useless and others impracticable. The natural desire of freedom is strengthened, and the independent mind revolts at the idea of subjection. Now, once again, this was something completely foreign to the European tradition. The European tradition was one in which an individual had a station in life that was assigned to him by virtue of accidents of birth. If you were a noble, if you were somebody who was part of a feudal aristocracy, your station in life was certainly more comfortable and more congenial to the enjoyment of your talents than somebody who was born as a serf or somebody who was born as a servant or a slave. And there was no concept in the European tradition at the time of the American founding of somebody having mobility out of the position in society in which he was born. Sometimes that would happen. Very rarely was an exceptional case when somebody would, as they put it, rise above his station in life, or her station in life, if you're dealing with female in this example. But here in the United States, once these people had crossed the Atlantic, and I think that it was fortuitous, probably providential is a better word to describe this, that the American settlers to come here from Europe had to cross the Atlantic rather than the Pacific, because the Pacific's a far more daunting passage. But once they had crossed the Atlantic with all the hazards that attended that passage, and they disembarked on what Fitzgerald called the fresh green breast of a new world, they probably felt that it would be not only silly and counterproductive, but perhaps even sinful, to reinstitute here in this new world the customs that had shackled so many people in the old world to a status of servitude. Granted, we did import into this country the practice of chattel slavery, and there were people who were sent here as indentured servants who were exiled from England, a great many of them, including ancestors in my family line, who were exiled here to the United States. But once they came here, there was a different type of a society that was created. It was fiercely individualistic. It was rooted in an understanding of the indispensable importance of acknowledging God as the source of our rights, not only the source of our very existence, and, of course, the source of our ultimate salvation, redemption, but the source of our rights here in this temporal sphere. And once you understand those things, once you understand that men are created, men and women, men in the most inclusive sense of that expression, are created equal before the law and equal before God, then there are political consequences for understanding this. And it was just inevitable that there was going to be a schism between the colonies and the mother country. The mother country, of course, clinging to many of those institutions that defined the feudal and aristocratic past, the hierarchy, the class structure, the peerages. These are things that we did not import here to the United States. And in that period between 1781 and 1787, when we had a loose confederacy of constitutional republics after they had achieved independence from Great Britain, there emerged something here culturally in the embryonic United States that was completely foreign to Europe, and that was the middle-class individual, the freeholder, the yeoman farmer, somebody who was not beholden to a lord, to a cleric, somebody who could own property, who could improve that property, who could bequeath it to his own heirs, somebody who had the prospect and promise of improvement and the promise of upward mobility. It was completely foreign to the European tradition. And that's where the concept of an American came from. And it's still, in terms of the effect that it has on our culture and on our understanding and our expectations, is still unique in the world. There really is nothing like it in history, this self-made, self-regulating individual who could mix his labor and his talent with the property that he'd acquired and improve it, and then take risks with it, invest it, speculate upon it, take principled action so as to improve and expand his property holdings and improve his life and the prospects for his children. These were things that were unique. And now we are living in a different type of a society here in 2009, very different from what we saw, what we read about in history from, say, 1779 or 1789. We're actually becoming more and more akin to the feudal and even the collectivist societies that we have read about in history and in some contemporary nations and political systems. This is because of the fact that our ruling elite, as you have pointed out so many times and so eloquently, Dr. Stan, has a different religious understanding of how the world is supposed to operate, of who God is and who man is and what our relationship should be. And their understanding is that they're made out of stuff just a little bit better than the common run of humanity, and that it is their privilege as leaders of the vanguard elite to order society for our purported benefit. And that conceit informs just about all the policies that descend from Washington, D.C., not only to rule and regulate the United States, but actually to regiment the rest of the world. And so we find ourselves in a situation that's ironically in many ways akin to that of our colonial forebears. They were in a position where they understood that the only way that they could take back the rights that were being stolen from them, that were part of their heritage as Englishmen, was to withdraw from the jurisdiction of the government that claimed to rule them. We find ourselves now in a situation where a number of states are trying to reclaim some of their reserve powers to protect the rights of the inhabitants of those states. I mean, take a look particularly at the Second Amendment resolutions that are being passed. That's a really good indication of the fact that the temper of our times is becoming more and more akin in some very important ways to the temper of the times, say, circa 1773 or 1774. But it remains an open question as to how many people in this country retain in their souls and in their understandings the impress of our founding principles. I think that there are many millions who do understand, if only, once again, in sort of an instinctive way, and that's what David Ramsey, was talking about in his summary of the attitudes before independence, that there was an instinctive understanding, if not a systematic understanding on the part of many of the American colonists, that there was this scheme that had to be followed, and there were rights that had to be protected, and that their primary loyalty and allegiance was to God, and that government serves the function of protecting rights, and if it doesn't serve that function, then that government really has to be either radically reformed or dispensed with altogether. I don't know how many people in our country today understand that what we celebrate on the 4th of July is an insurrection. It's an insurrection that was staged for eminently practical and moral reasons. But it was an insurrection. These people were seditionists. They did seek to overthrow a government. They sought to overthrow a colonial government that was by the rules of the government, or the system that they were living under, that was the legitimate government that held sovereignty over the colonies. But they undertook what they did out of the necessity of protecting the liberties that government was supposed to protect. And they confronted severe, almost unimaginable, horrific punishment if they had failed. For those who've seen the movie Braveheart, recall how William Wallace, as depicted in that movie, met his end. That was a sanitized version of the penalty for treason.
And I think what's so important for people to understand, William, is that at that time in history, in 1776, there was no freedom really anywhere in the world. Certainly, there are some countries like England, the average person had certain rights, but they were granted by the king. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was always this relationship between whoever the ruler was and the church. And, of course, the dominant church in England was the Anglican church, and they would persecute anybody who didn't go along with the Anglican religion. In Europe, it was the Catholic church, and they would prosecute you if you didn't go along, if you were a Protestant and wouldn't accept this combination rule of the monarchies, the kings, and literally every country was governed by a king with a religious justification for it. And here was a group of people who were saying, look, we want to be free. We're Christians, we believe in God, but we don't believe that religion should be working with government to oppress us. We came here to get away from the King of England and the influence of the Anglican Church. And there was really all throughout the world at that time a revolutionary ferment that wanted to establish a society where men could be free. This is what people had always dreamed of.
Mm-hmm.
And here, in the first time in history, that was accomplished with the power of government, and the power of the church as an organized body was to be limited.
Mm-hmm.
A few years later, well, we had the French Revolution, and what did they do? They did away with God. They killed off all the Catholic priests and the nuns, and they tried to have man without God create a perfect society that would regulate the people. And well, we know how that ended up.
Yeah.
We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg as we continue talking about the wonderful heritage we had here in America. It's about time we tried to reclaim it. William, you go right ahead.
I'm really glad that you brought up the fact that there was a religious component here, not only in terms of the understanding of where our rights come from, in terms of our rights being gifts of the Creator, but also a religious component in terms of trying to break up the cartel that was created by the consolidation of church and state. And this is a subject that is fraught with misunderstanding, because if you talk about the fact that church and state have to be kept separate, certain people of a conservative disposition will say, well, no, that's not something that the Constitution frankly says. No, it doesn't. The Constitution does not have the phrase about the separation of church and state, but what it does is, by refusing to grant to Congress the power to create a state church, and by explicitly forbidding Congress to establish a state church, it is preventing the type of consolidation of power where the church reinforces the claims of an unaccountable government at the injury to the injury of those who are ruled. And that, of course, is why you have that very important provision in the First Amendment, and why the Constitution itself, of course, is written in such a way to discourage the creation of this type of a corrupt condominium between church and state. And when you bring up what happened in the French Revolution, it's interesting that the first attempt that they made, that lasted between roughly 1789, and I've been thinking about 1792, was to extract entirely from that society, France, of course, being the oldest Catholic country on earth. It's always been referred to as the oldest daughter of the church by Catholic historians, is that they tried to strip mine from French society anything that savored of Christian concepts of the Catholic tradition in order to have a completely secular and humanistic approach to governing, and to have a culture that was completely barren of religious influence. And that didn't work. I mean, these things were being done by a group of people who believed that they could start the world anew. They actually went so far as to restart the calendar. If you have a calendar that uses as its foundational year the mortal advent of Jesus Christ, that, of course, is something that has a religious connotation that will focus, however implicitly, the minds of people upon that event as being the signal event of human history, and so they started over again. They rewrote the calendar with the, instead of using the conventional names for months, they had a calendar that was written with months referring to the seasons. At one point, I believe, actually tried to institute a 10-day week rather than 7 days. Why do we have a 7-day week, you ask? Well, it's because the Bible talks about 6 days of creation, and on the seventh day God rested from his labors. That's why we have a 7-day week. And so they went so far as to break up that connection in culture and history in order to secularize France. None of this worked. So they pivoted on a dime, and they introduced what they called the cult of the Supreme Being. Well, what is the Supreme Being? According to Robespierre and others who promoted this idea, the Supreme Being is incarnate reason, and they chose as the incarnation of reason a prostitute whom they sat in the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And, of course, this was a calculated insult to the sensibilities of Catholics and other Christians for that matter. And so this is something that reified the hostility of the ruling elite in the French Revolution to religion and Christianity. But it was also something that recognized that they had to have something by way of a cultus that is organized worship as the foundation for a government. You know, every government, every society is the outgrowth of certain understandings about our origins and our destiny.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and William is talking about really what had happened in France after their revolution. Remember, our revolution started in 1776. By 1787, why we had written the Constitution, but 2 years later, they had a revolution in France. And they were going to try to accomplish what we had accomplished in the United States, creating a new society, doing away with the influence of the Catholic Church, doing away with the French monarchy. And, of course, what they did, of course, was to create a totally chaotic situation, because man cannot live without God. And mm-hmm. by repudiating God, they got themselves into all sorts of problems. They tried to create a perfect humanist society. It didn't work. They tried to repeal the laws of finances by creating paper money, very similar to what we've done recently. And it didn't work then. It's not going to work now. Is well told in that wonderful book, Fiat Money, Inflation in France. Mm-hmm. But within just a handful of years, now they had, they had a committee. They were governed by 12 people, and then by 3 people, and then by one person. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte, and they were right back into a monarchy. But you pick up the story there.
And one of the first things that Napoleon did was repudiate fiat money and reinstitute the gold standard. He was many contemptible things, Bonaparte, but he was not stupid, and he understood that there was no possible way that he could carry out his agenda, which was to careen about Europe, consolidating a new empire, and then installing his relatives on the satrap thrones of these various conquered provinces. He couldn't do this unless he had a strong foundation, a strong economic base. But it's so fascinating. You talk about the way that you started out with the people ruling, you know, the well, this was a different kind of an insurrection. This was an insurrection that was intended to rebel against the settled and established principles that had governed man for millennia. That's not what the American Revolution was all about. The American Revolution was a revolution in the sense of turning back to something that was sound and historically valid, an understanding of man's rights. The colonists talked about their rights as Englishmen, that they had a heritage that had been ensured to them by the Anglo-Saxon tradition of liberty under law going back to Runnymede and even before, at 1215 with the Magna Carta. But they were revolting in the sense that they were trying to turn back to something, whereas the French Revolution was a rebellion against God's law and an attempt to restart the world on a radically different premise, set of premises. And when you do that, of course, you're ensuring that a whole lot of people are going to get killed in a hurry. And so you end up with this revolution being waged in the name of the people. And that out of the people, you have, of course, an elite that arises that is the mountain. And the mountain is a smaller clique, but dozens of people. And out of that comes the Committee on Public Safety, which is a couple of dozen. And then you have a dozen people who are the presiding authority of the Committee on Public Safety. And then you end up with a triumvirate, and eventually you have the one man as the dictator, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan. That's the natural progression of a democratic revolution that is not banked by law and is intended to bring about a radical transformation of society, as opposed to an effort to reclaim our rights, as our rights are understood by people who have a fundamental grasp of biblical principles, you know, things that are written down in by way of understanding God's law and the application of God's law to society. And the colonists at the time of the American Revolution were very Bible literate. You can go back and read the outpouring of literature that accompanied this second Great Awakening that took place in the mid-1700s, where you had pamphlets and circulars and monographs being disseminated by the thousands. It seemed as if everybody had a printing press. It was almost as if in the later part of the mid-1700s, you had the Gutenberg-era version of the blogosphere. I mean, today you can hang out a shingle on the blogosphere and open up your own blog and advertise your thoughts to the world. Back then, everybody had a printing press in his backyard or in his shop, and they would issue flyers and decrees or decretals and all kinds of instruments in order to participate in this political conversation. And there's a wonderful book that was written about that subject by Bernard Bailyn of Harvard University called The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution. And he went back and he read as many of those writings as are still extant. This would have been about 1965 he wrote the first edition of that book. He's updated it a couple of times since. But what he pointed out is that the consensus, the agreed upon understanding in almost all these writings is that there had been a conspiracy against liberty in the English-speaking world that was beginning to make its effects felt in the colonies in the early 1760s, when the British Ministry for the Americas started to impose new duties, mean taxes, on various kinds of trade and commerce for the purpose of building up the garrisons of the British military in the colonies. And you can actually find in some studies of the American Revolution, I mean, Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, it's a four-volume set, the first volume of that history, quotes John Adams and a number of other people, including a couple of...
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening is William Grigg, and we are going to have a quick announcement here by Susan, who's from the Freedom Forum in the Santa Cruz area. Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Do you have want to tell our listeners about your next meeting?
Thank you. I'd love to. Freedom Forum is going to show part one of a brand new movie hot off the press called Frankenfed, and it is about this... monster that is roaming our country and creating our wars and enslaving us and future generations. A lot of people don't know that the Federal Reserve is instrumental in creating the wars that we fight and all the debt that we have in our country. Not all the debt, but some, a lot of it. And it'll be on July 8th, 7 p.m. Wednesday at the Quaker Friends Meeting House on 225 Rooney Street. It's free and we'll show also segments of Principles of Liberty and show what good standards that we need to follow and to know about for good government.
All right. Now, of course, this is on the Frontage Road, takes off of Morrissey Boulevard.
That's right.
And it's at a Quaker church there. Now, once again, the address.
It is Quaker Friends Meeting House at 225 Rooney Street.
How do you spell what street?
R-O-O-N-E-Y.
Rooney Street.
Right.
Okay, fine. So that'll be a good time. What time does it start?
7 p.m. and it's free.
Okay, that's next Wednesday. And, of course, I'm sure they wouldn't be above taking a donation, but they need help. They're doing a great job getting the information out. How many people are getting out to some of these meetings?
Well, last time was really the best attended event. That was with Michael Shaw. We had probably about 57 folks.
All right, fine. Well, if you have a chance to get there, these people need your help and support. If we aren't going to be doing anything, believe me, the other side is. Hey,
right.
Thanks so very much,
thanks,
Susan.
Dr. Stan.
God bless. Bye-bye. And, of course, that's Susan from the Freedom Forum, and you go right ahead, William.
I was talking about the fact that in Murray Rothbard's History of the American Revolution, he documents the understanding on the part of a number of American patriots, including John Adams. And also he documents from the writings of a number of British figures the fact that the British government was plotting, or conspiring, if you want to use that word, to use the continued threat of Indian attacks as a pretext to build up the military garrisons in the colonies so as to ensure the subjection of the American colonists to the will of the British government. And, of course, the taxes which are being imposed and the impositions that were being made on commerce were all intended to defray the cost of building up this army of occupation that was going to regiment.
Hold that thought. Hold the thought there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this course is William Grigg. He's talking about how the British, this was during, of course, the colonial days, were doing everything they could to build up the threat of the Indian attacks on the colonists so the colonists would rally behind their government to protect them and it would form militias to protect them from the wicked Indians who in many instances were being encouraged to attack by the very British because they wanted to be able to have the militia to keep the people in control. And just as today we're told, oh my goodness, you know, the wicked terrorists want to take away our freedom, so that's why we've got to have ever more government control and stand in long lines at the airport and take off our shoes because, after all, we might have a bomb in our shoes. Remember Mr. Reed, of course, the mad shoe bomber who was trying to light the fuse, you know, to the C4 with a match. But of course, he doesn't understand. You can't light C4 with a match. You can burn C4 with a fire. You know, they used to burn it for heat, but that isn't how you light it off. It was all set up that he'll spend the rest of his life in prison for a crime he never could have committed. Could you imagine sitting next to some big fellow, you know, who's trying to light a fuse in his shoe? And of course, eventually, after a while, they finally got his shoes away from him and found that they did have C4 in them, but you can't set it off with a fuse. Anyway, right now, of course, our guest is William Grigg. We're talking about what's going on in America today. We're talking about what happened when America was founded as a colony and the beliefs of our founders in this idea of freedom under God. Because, of course, tomorrow is our celebrate our Declaration of Independence, and nobody's going to talk about the fact that our founding fathers believed, of course, we could be free because God made men to be free. And our Constitution was laid out so that we could have a limited government, and but you could only have limited government if you had moral and religious people. That, of course, is why they're doing everything they can to destroy the morality of our people and, of course, to promote everything which is an affront to God. Well, before we go on, William, I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can listen to your radio program, how they can get your book. Of course, we do carry a book, Liberty and Eclipse, but I want you to put in a little plug for yourself.
I do appreciate that, Dr. Stan. I have a blog called Pro Libertate, and there are a number of ways to reach it. The direct address to my blog is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Freedom in our time is one word. It's a compound word. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Or you can go to willgrigg.com, and if you go to that front page of that website, look at the right-hand side of the screen, you'll find a list of external links, and Pro Libertate is the first link. That's my blog. I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week. Over the last couple of weeks, I've had a number of domestic concerns that have detracted from my production schedule, so their postings recently have been a little bit thin, but that's going to pick up again. There's a fresh essay on there yesterday. And when I talk about essays, I'm not merely talking about 2 or 3 paragraph commentaries on the writings of other people. My blog is a little different in that I write essays that tend to be between 1,200 and 2,000 words in length, and I'm trying to abbreviate them. I'm always trying to write more briefly so as not to tax the attention of my readers. But if those essays are read to the end, I try to reward the reader by giving them an opportunity to buy my book, Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror, The Rise of the Homeland Security State. There's a thumbnail portrait of the cover art from that book at the end of every essay, right next to a hyperlink, which will take the reader to Amazon to buy the book. They want to do it that way. And as you mentioned, it is carried, of course, by your fine network, Radio Liberty. The other thing that has happened recently, just within the last 3 weeks, is I've started a daily radio program of my own, an hour-long program during the weekdays, on the Liberty News Radio Network, and the radio program is also called Pro Libertate. It just seemed like a good name for it. Why mess with something that's good and distinctive? It's from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock Mountain Time. I live in the Mountain Time Zone, which would translate to 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock Central. And if you're living in a place that doesn't yet have an affiliate of the Liberty News Radio Network, it's likely that your listening audience resides in places where this is not yet available because Liberty News Radio has only been in existence for about a year or so. And we have a small but expanding number of affiliates. We're picking up affiliates in the Midwest, for instance, over the last couple of weeks. But go to libertynewsradio.com. And there are many, many ways you can listen to the program online. And it's also rebroadcast, but right now we don't have a regular rebroadcast schedule for the programs. It's part of the process of working out the kinks of the schedule. They're trying to add new programs, and as they add new programs, that of course has the effect of altering when the rebroadcasts are available. But the programs are archived, and if you log on to libertynewsradio.com between 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock Central Time, or 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock Mountain Time, you can listen to the simulcast online. And it's been a lot of fun to be doing a radio show, because this is a more immediate way of reaching people, as you can appreciate, Dr. Stan, having been one of the pioneers of this medium, political talk radio. There are very few ways that are more immediate in terms of reaching people, and very few avenues that are more accessible to the audience, because people are always busy doing things. People who are leading productive lives are busy working, they're busy driving, they're traveling to and from work or other useful engagements. And radio, of course, is a medium you can take literally anywhere with you. And so I'm really excited and honored to have this opportunity. I certainly hope this is something that's gonna find its audience and flourish, because I really enjoy the medium. And I think that in the age of the Internet, it's by no means obsolete. I think that it is probably the most user-friendly medium for advertising one's thoughts and principles that we have. I don't think anything's going to come along that's going to replace it anytime soon. But you know, that gives you an idea of what I'm up to, and I do keep busy.
Well, I know you do, and I agree with you. I believe that radio is the last means by which we can reach large numbers of people. And fortunately, there's a growing number of people who are really getting the information out there, and we're glad to have you added to the list of those who are on the front lines of the battle by this medium. So pick up the story from there.
Well, we're talking about how it was that the colonists discerned that there was this conspiracy. We might as well use the word conspiracy, because that was a word which appeared in a lot of the writings of the period on the part of the British government to reduce the American colonists to a state of outright peonage, where essentially they would be living in a mercantilist system where they would have no prospect for being independently prosperous. They would be consigned to the lowest rungs of this hierarchical class structure that was part of the old European ways of doing things. There's a wonderful story about Benjamin Franklin visiting Ireland when he was the ambassador to the court of St. James, and seeing how the Irish were being forced to live, and understanding how the Americans were going to be living in mud huts and hovels and be reduced to the status of little better than chattel slaves within a couple of generations if the American colonists did not take the necessary action to meet that threat and turn back the threat of outright imposed destitution. And it's interesting as well when you understand that there were people on the other side of the Atlantic in the English political system who understood what was being done to the American colonists and were mortified by it. One of them was Edmund Burke, and that might be a reflection of the fact that Edmund Burke was ethnically Irish. He might have understood perhaps some of the same things that Benjamin Franklin reportedly had come to understand. But there was another fellow by the name of Colonel Isaac Barret, who had fought during the French and Indian War, which was the American front of the so-called 7 Years' War between England and Great Britain. And he had come to understand the character of the American colonists and something of the nature of the vast American wilderness. And he came to understand that it was no longer possible to pretend that the Americans were English, that the Americans were a separate country. They were a different culture. They had a different understanding of how government should be run. And when Charles Townsend, who was the author of a lot of the intolerable acts that were imposed upon the colonists to extract revenue from them so as to provide the means of encouraging the growth of the British occupation force here in the colonies, Charles Townsend gave a speech in Parliament talking about the ingratitude of the American colonists. They were so ungrateful to the mother country that had nurtured them and provided them with all the many beneficences of the colonial system and the imperial system and how ungrateful they were for the protection that the mother country afforded, Colonel Beret stood up and said the following. They planted by your care? No, your oppressions planted them in America. They fled from tyranny to a then uncultivated and unhospitable country, where they exposed themselves to almost all the hardships to which human nature is liable, and among others to the cruelty of a savage foe, the most subtle, and I will take upon me to say the most formidable of any people upon the face of God's earth, and yet actuated by principles of true English liberty, they, meaning the American colonists, met all hardships with pleasure compared with those they suffered in their own country from the hands of those that should have been their friends. They were nourished up by your indulgence. They grew by your neglect of them. As soon as you began to care about them, that care was exercised in sending persons to rule them in one department and another, who were perhaps the deputies of deputies to some members of this house, sent to spy out their liberties, to misrepresent their actions, and to prey upon them. Now, Isaac Beret was not having any of the sanctimonious hypocrisy of the British government pretending that they were the friends of liberty for the American colonists when they were extracting from them their wealth and using that wealth to create this huge army of occupation, the intention of which was to reduce them to outright slavery. And he articulated a principle that Americans now understand, perhaps at a chromosomal level, even if they don't understand the ideology of it, and that's the idea of rugged individualism. Leave us alone.
And, of course, you know, what's really so frightening today, William, is the fact that they do have a network of informants across America. And I know I was personally recruited some 45 years or so ago, maybe 46 years ago, to become an informant, just simply to prepare reports regularly, going to cocktail parties, who said what. I know other people who've been in that position. We know the Randy Weaver, the fellow who wanted to live alone in the Idaho wilderness. His best friend was actually an FBI informant who was sent there to spy on him. Certainly, Pat Matriciano put out a DVD called The Clinton Chronicles in 1994. Turned out one of his best friends was a FBI informant, Rupert Murdoch, who wrote the book Crossing the Rubicon. Turned out one of his best friends was an FBI informant.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a best friend, you better look at him very, very cleverly and very, very closely. You know, of course, they're listening to all of our telephone conversation through Project Echelon, ECHELON. They've been doing it for a long time, having nothing to do with the war on terror. You can check it out on the Internet. Find out about Project Echelon, where every telephone call in the entire world, of course, is siphoned up and recorded on a computer, and I'm sure they have our program tonight carefully recorded. Understand that this fear of spies that they had at the time of pre-revolutionary days in our colonies, why, of course, has been really refined electronically today. Which go right ahead.
Yeah, we have to assume that if we're going to be doing anything worthwhile, that people who are interested in propagating tyranny are going to take notice of what we're doing. And my approach has always been to say, well, I might as well make myself as conspicuous as possible, because there's no real point in trying to be something other than what I am. And I certainly think that we should understand as well that in the ranks of the people that we're looking upon now as rivals and potential enemies, who are fellow Americans by birth, if not by conviction, in terms of the principles of Americanism, never underestimate the possibility of defectors in place. That is to say, people whose conscience has not yet been seared with a hot iron, who can respond to a principled plea based on our common language and our common heritage of liberty under law, and that in the most unlikely places in this bureaucracy and infrastructure of regimentation and surveillance, you might find some people who will undergo a road to Damascus type experience, where suddenly they'll understand that they're really on the wrong side of certain very important questions. And it's my hope that we'll be able to reach people like that in sufficient numbers that we can obviate the possibility of having an outright breakdown of our civil society and a type of internecine conflict that could take on a really tragic character. You know, God forbid that we would actually have a full-throttle civil conflict erupt in this country of the sort that we've seen in countries like Lebanon and Bosnia in other places in the world, where if you had a complete breakdown and a schism in this country, I honestly believe it would make, you know, Rwanda and Bosnia look like slap fights in comparison to what could happen here. But we have to understand as well that irrespective of which direction we go, if it's a peaceful reformation or something that's more of the nature of a revolution, in order to reclaim our liberties, things have to change radically. We cannot sustain the system that we have right now. It cannot be sustained. It's collapsing right now under the weight of its own fraudulence. When you take a look at the economy, the fiat money system, the system of debt, that really is an unfortunate legacy of Alexander Hamilton, a man who distinguished himself in many ways, but believed that debt could be the cement that bound together the Union. And so, and to that extent, you know, there was a very important flaw in the very foundation of our republic. And that's something, of course, that had to be attended to, and it was not. It was something that grew into a major feature of the system that's replaced the republic we were given. But these things that we're talking about now in terms of comprehensive surveillance, regimentation of the economy, the adulteration of our currency, our continued improvident foreign policy and meddling in the affairs of other countries, and, of course, the efforts by certain people to cultivate and to nourish this dream of a world order that would be founded upon principles entirely foreign to the God-ordained principles of liberty, these things cannot sustain themselves. These things are going to have to be uprooted. They're going to have to be destroyed. And it is my earnest hope that this can be done peacefully with as little tumult and violence as possible. But whether it's done that way or in some other way, we're in for some profoundly interesting times. Some profoundly unsettling things are going to happen. I believe some tragic things will take place, which means that we have to refurbish our souls as frequently as possible in the Word of God, spend a lot of time on our knees, and be willing to stand up and confront those who seek our liberties with erect backbones and lifted chins.
Amen to that. Well, I certainly agree. We're in for difficult times. The America we've known doesn't exist today. Whether we can reclaim it is a serious question, and only God knows the answer to that question. But we are called upon to do our best and to be involved in this battle. Whether you want to or not, you're involved. And that old adage, you know, you can either say no, you know, on your feet, or you may very well be saying yes, please, when you're on your knees. For brave men die in foxholes, but many men die in foxholes. Some go down in flames, but most men die just bit by bit, playing foolish little games. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Every time we have a conversation like this, Dr. Stan, I wonder if it's a good idea to do what I'm going to attempt to do now, which is to acknowledge that for all the problems that we have, and they are vast and they are deepening, and for all the dismal and ominous things that we see approaching us on the horizon, that it is still a blessing to live here in this country. I've lived abroad. I have worked abroad. I've visited many countries and many continents. I've been to the Middle East. I've been to Africa. I've lived in Latin America. I've spent some time in Europe. I've got some friends who, after catching a scent of what's in the wind with respect to the advent of absolute unfiltered tyranny in this country and the collapse of our economy, have been choosing the route of expatriates, going to other countries, going to places in the Caribbean, Latin America, some places in Europe. And I've been invited to join them. And I've said, no, I can't leave. Irrespective of what happens here, no matter how grim it becomes, this is my country. This is where I'm going to stay. And I love my country too much to allow the enemy to have an uncontested battlefield when it comes to the fate of the country that I love. And it's still a wonderful place to live, irrespective of the problems that we're talking about. We're still blessed with people who are, in terms of the context of the world around us, more inclined to listen to sound principle, if not necessarily to act on it. We're dealing now with the beginnings of what promises to be a very grave depression. But when compared with other countries, we're still very, very well off. And we still have the capacity and the opportunity right now to prepare ourselves financially and physically against those things that are soon to descend upon our country. So in this interim now, in this blessed interval, before the worst starts to occur, let's take stock of the fact that it's still a blessing to be an American, and it's still a blessing to live here in this wonderful, beautiful country, this incomparably blessed country, beautiful in every way that the country can be measured. It's something that's worth fighting for. It's worth living for. And it's something that I don't intend to give up without a fight, without giving every ounce of what God has granted to me by way of time and talents to preserve it.
Well, I appreciate all you're doing, William and Sydney. We truly are involved in a battle for the survival of our nation. We can reclaim it. We have a heritage of freedom. The Constitution is still the law of the land. The usurpers are in control. They hate the Constitution. They're violating the oath they've sworn to uphold our Constitution. But we have right on our side. Let's hope that God will bless our efforts. Good night. God bless. Have a wonderful 4th of July.
You too. Take care, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with William Grigg. And I would reiterate what I just said, and that is that we live in a wonderful country with a wonderful heritage. Unfortunately, the people who are in control, the Brotherhood of Darkness, the people who control the Obama administration, the same people who control the second Bush administration and the Clinton administration and the first Bush administration and the Reagan administration and the Carter administration, and as we pointed out, between 1976 and the year 2008, every president of the United States and or vice president of the United States came from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission, which is a subversive organization intent upon seizing control of the government of the United States as a stepping stone to seizing control of the financial and commercial interests of the world. And if you doubt what I'm saying, you need to read Barry Goldwater's book, With No Apologies, page 280. And if you don't have the book, we'll be glad to send you the page. That's what Barry Goldwater said in 1979, and it's absolutely true. If you want to get a verification source of information, go to my website, radioliberty.com, and just read our newsletters. I suggest, if you'd like, start with October of 2008. We talked about the oil crisis, the phony oil crisis, all created by the same people, and then simply read November, December, January, February, March, April, May, to understand this whole financial crisis has been intentionally created as a vehicle to bring suffering to the American people, and the criminals that are involved in it, of course, are members of the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you don't know who the Brotherhood is, you need to read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch the DVD. It's free up on the Internet at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, our website. Or get the book, and then, of course, and it's just incidentally been re-released and with a different cover and being featured this month in Prophecy in the News. Then, of course, you need to get our talk on The Forbidden Secret and the syllabus that goes with that. And then the financial Armageddon talk and the syllabus that goes with that. It will give you the documentation that you need to be effective in this battle. And then, of course, we want you to copy. You have our permission to copy our DVDs, to copy our syllabuses. Yes, if you can get people to buy them from us, we'll appreciate it. But if not, copy it and get people to watch it so they can begin to understand the true spiritual nature of the forces of the people on the other side. We have an excellent source of the membership list of the Brotherhood of Darkness. It's a syllabus we put together. That's the syllabus on the entitled The Membership List of the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you want to know why the Obama administration turned the Chrysler Corporation over to an Italian company named Fiat, and they didn't even put up any money. They got 20% of a major American corporation without putting up any money. And they can, according to the agreement, come up with 50% of the company. Why would we turn a major American company over to an Italian corporation? Why, very simply, because the president and vice president, or chairman and vice chairman of Fiat, are members of the Trilateral Commission, the Italian branch of that. understand that nothing is it appears to be. Have you ever read that in the newspaper? And of course, no more than you'll read the reason they took God and prayer out of our schools was because, of course, the members of the Supreme Court came from the Masonic movement. And of course, all of these things interlock together. I recently was told by a friend of mine who went to the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C., the headquarters of the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite, that they have a list there of the people who have donated over $1 million to bring about the world government. And on that list was the name of the George Bush family, the George Bush family. So understand that, of course, I don't know whether they're Masons, but certainly the secret society that they do belong to, Skull and Bones, is intimately involved with this whole world occult movement of the Brotherhood of Darkness. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm certainly our telephone number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.